God of creation, there at the start, before the beginning of time. With no point of reference, you spoke to the dark and fleshed out the wonder of life.
Hello, everyone. This is Kathleen Francis, the host of Wise Women. And we're really excited today because we have a wonderful guest from my neck of the woods. And she has an extraordinary story. And this purpose for this show, as Gary Null has always asked to do, is to inspire others to greater inspirations of efforts in their life and understandings about how to live their life better and be a more contributing force in this wonderful planet that we have to live in. And Natalie Warren is certainly that and more. So please help me welcome Natalie Warren. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. My pleasure. So where were you born, sweetie?
I was born in Miami, Florida, but I currently live in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Very good. Yes, I had the great pleasure of listening to some of the videos, and we are going to make sure that we direct people to those places of inspired conversations that you have. I, too, am from the Northwoods. I was born in a small town in Wisconsin, Hurley, Wisconsin, which is 100 miles from Duluth, Minnesota, where I was a weathercaster, believe it or not, and had a show called Outdoor Adventures. Can you believe it?
Yeah, that's awesome.
But my adventures were nothing like yours, that's for sure. So with that said, and I had a couple of wonderful guests also in the area of athletic achievements. I guess it's athleticism. And if you're familiar with Gary Null, he has so many awards for his marathon races and really, really works on inspiring people to new heights of what their capabilities might be. And so with that, would you please begin your adventure with this whole wonderful, and state what your achievements are?
Yeah, so most of the expeditions that I have been on have been in a canoe. So I'm from Miami, Florida. I actually didn't grow up doing anything athletic at all. I went to an art school. I was playing saxophone a lot. And then I signed up for a wilderness camp in northern Minnesota in a place called the Boundary Waters when I was 15. And my first time overnight camping was a 2-week canoe trip through the Boundary Waters. And I absolutely fell in love with being uncomfortable, troubleshooting, working with a team and problem solving, and found I actually was thriving in those situations. And so I went the next summer on a 30-day canoe trip in Ontario. The summer after that, I went on a 50-day canoe trip in Nunavut, Canada, the northernmost province just below the Arctic Ocean, paddling through the tundra on Inuit heritage whitewater rivers. And then, at this point, I was only 18.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Anne Bancroft is the one that suggested having you on as a guest, because she we've been having a little difficulty getting her scheduled. And of course, she is an international North Pole explorer, and she did 58 days on dog sleds to the North Pole. So we have some wonderfully adventurous women. So carry on from there.
Anne is such an inspiration. That really, at that point, I was just sort of ruined to continue these travels. And after college, my friend and I, 2 days after we graduated, we left on an 85-day expedition. We became the first two women to canoe publicly from Minneapolis to Hudson Bay. So we paddled the Minnesota River, the Red River, Lake Winnipeg, and then we're on Arctic rivers out to Hudson Bay, just south of Churchill. And then 2 years after
85 that, days.
Yeah, that was the longest one, 85 days.
Oh, my goodness.
And then, yep, just two more big trips after that, really, where I paddled the length of the Mississippi. So I have a canoe in my garage that actually has split North America in half in terms of, you know, it's been up to the bay and it's been down to the Gulf. And then in 2016, I paddled in the Yukon River Quest with five other women, and we got first place in the Voyagers division, paddling 444 miles in 53 hours. So that was,
oh my goodness,
a short one, but a fast one.
Well, that's quite amazing. And are you familiar with Anita DeFrans?
I'm not.
Well, she is on the Olympic Committee, and she was another extraordinary athlete. She was the gold medalist on the let's see, I'm not sure, the Summer Olympics, I think it was. Yeah, because she was on the rowing team and won. So, you know, she was on a couple of weeks ago, and she too is making such wonderful contributions, not just with her athletic endeavors, although she is the International Olympic Committee membership, you know, part of that whole group. So I know that you, I watched the video online about you, and you sang, you're very articulate, you're poetic in the way you express yourself. You read parts from your journal that I thought were so inspiring.
Thank you.
And then you started one of yours with the song that you wrote. And you know, you are definitely multifaceted. And I know, what is your passion at this moment?
Yeah, well, you know, music has always been a big passion of mine, and that's taken different forms and different parts of my life. And so it's been a core of, you know, who I am and my identity. So playing saxophone and singing and playing some guitar. And I have a 2-year-old and I'm 5 months pregnant. So I'm keeping that alive through parenting in new ways. And really, I think, you know, I talked about all these sort of athletic achievements, but really the main part of all of those is figuring out how I enjoy learning and how I want to experience the world. And that, although I no longer at this phase of my life feel like I can be leaving for 3 or 4 months at a time on my own, just with family responsibilities and new things like that. But the concept of moving around where you live, or paddling or walking or skiing, you know, whatever it is, as a form of getting to know a place and getting to know people, I think is foundational for me. And that's what I really took away from all of those expeditions, is a way of learning and a way of knowing where you are and who else lives there. And that can look like a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But for me, it's sort of transferred into incorporating paddling more into a day-to-day thing instead of a month-to-month thing, and getting to know my neighborhood in a more intimate way.
You know, I think that's such a wonderful perspective to bring into the conversation. Now, I live in Arizona, where, of course, the worldwide known Sedona Red Rock Country is, and of course people come here to climb the Red Rocks, and sometimes they do so with the wrong shoes and are not experienced, and many of them end up hurt and some die on these Red Rocks, thinking it's just so easy to do. And I know that you know, on some of your journeys, that danger existed as well. Were there people that tried to do the things you did and didn't make it home?
Definitely. A lot of people attempted this route to Hudson Bay. So my book, Hudson Bay Bound, was released in 2021. And that, I'd say, is my biggest accomplishment is paddling from Minneapolis to Hudson Bay. And that is a really dangerous route. It's not something that you can just really hop into because you're paddling upstream, you're paddling, the 11th largest lake in the world, you're paddling really quick whitewater rivers. And yeah, we definitely had some scary moments. And coming from two women who were trained in canoe expeditions, and so we do have to grapple with that balance of risk and safety and preparedness very often.
For sure. Well, again, this is of course, a radio network, and I wish that we could see the beautiful photographs and all of the footage that I saw online. How would people see that particular video that I saw? So, because I think it really was so inspiring. And of course, you open it with your adorable song that you wrote. You wrote the song, right?
No, actually, that's Across the Great Divide. A couple people who have done covers of that. I'm most familiar with the Nancy Griffith one. But I do, through my website, it's natalie-warren.com. I have all of our expedition blogs on there. I have information about my book. I have links to different videos. And then there's a lot on YouTube in terms of if you just search Hudson Bay Bound. We had it was 2011 when we did this specific expedition. And the mobile technologies have changed quite a bit since then, as you can imagine. And so we had, our first edition GoPro or something. And we were able to capture quite a bit that we edited into short videos about each segment of the trip.
Wow. Wow. So what were some of the biggest challenges on that journey?
This expedition is really divided into four parts. When we were paddling the Minnesota River, leaving from Minneapolis, St. Paul, where the Minnesota River flows into the Mississippi, it was June 2nd, 2011, and the water was crested 20 feet above normal, so really big floodwaters. And we had to paddle upstream against those for the first 330 miles.
Oh, my goodness.
So needless to say, that was challenging. It was very humbling. We were moving 1.5 miles an hour. We could have walked the river faster than we canoed it.
Oh, my goodness.
You just got to be consistent and persistent and appreciate that you're finally on this journey and not feel defeated, that you're barely inching along against these heavy floodwaters with, entire trees floating downstream.
Oh, my God.
And going under bridges and just all these things with the hydrology that you learn very quickly, and you become an expert on reading water as you're moving with a system like that.
So for you to start from that place, that's incredible. I was raised on Lake Superior because we had a deep sea fishing resort. And a few years back, we had 10 inches of rain and the creek flooded, and actually people died in that. And it put 80 boats out to sea, sunk most of them. So I know firsthand what it looks like when you're talking about that kind, and definitely where trees and God knows everything coming down there, and you had to go through that. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it was, it's not recommended for not expert paddlers. And Anne and I were really safe on our journey in that we would try something and see how we felt in that space. you hear a lot of stories from people about, you know, whether or not you should do something or how you should do it. And you get a lot of advice. We heard from a lot of people who knew people who had drowned on Lake Winnipeg. And, you know, we're not carelessly throwing ourselves into these situations in which we're going to put ourselves in needless danger just for, you know, some sort of conquest of a journey that wasn't our mindset at all. You know, we really wanted to see this landscape and to meet these people, and we were moving slowly and we were trying to do it in whatever way worked best for us. And so if something felt too dangerous, we'd pull over and we would wait it out. But on the Minnesota River, it's just it's a slog of paddling forward. You can't stop to take a picture or else you slide right back. So you're just moving right along.
Wow. And what did you, in this, let's say, challenge, a personal challenge, what do you feel was the, what you gained in terms of your own depth of character? That were there moments or a general sense of how this affected you as a human being?
Absolutely. I'm very much a big picture person. So I like the idea of paddling to Hudson Bay, for example, and what it takes to actually do that is not as romantic as the story sounds. And that was immediately apparent on this part of the expedition where you are operating, you know, a minute at a time, and you feel within an hour every emotion from frustration to I can do this to, you know, you're singing a song and then you're arm hurts so badly that you feel like you can't move anymore. And then it's just moment after moment, you kind of realize that you can move on from those different feelings and challenges, and that they're going to ebb and they're going to flow. And I think specifically the Minnesota River taught me that you can do anything with small breaks. If you feel defeated, you pull over, you recharge, and you can take off again, and you just have to do that over and over. So it's a slow, slow process to actually make it to Hudson Bay. You know, every paddle stroke ends up mattering in the end, and just trying to understand all those tiny pieces along the way to get there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think those things you shared could definitely be applied to our own lives, you know?
Yes, absolutely.
Especially in these challenging times.
Yep. Yeah, it's interesting as a mom now. You know, people were always telling me when I was first pregnant, it's like, oh, you've done all these things. Parenting's going to be somehow easy for me. And really, it's this expedition all over again in some ways, in that it's really hard and it's a lot of different emotions and understandings of the world and one thing. And it just keeps, you know, happening, and you have to keep dealing with it as you go along. And so this understanding of breaks, of like being humbled by an experience and not constantly just thinking about the big picture, because in reality, you know, you have an infant and it's a day at a time.
I think that's a beautifully stated thing that we can apply to those who are listening. Again, you know, the purpose of this show is to assist people, to give them wisdom, to hear those who have taken journeys of various ways to empower themselves, and then hopefully share that information and empower others to either inspire possibilities of what you've done physically, or to apply the principles that you've gained in whatever it is that they're doing in their lives. And I know young people today, I feel that so many of them are lost in video game things and things that don't bring them to the outdoors. You know, in the North Woods where I was raised, I mean, Anne, you spoke of your partner in this journey, who was raised in the North Woods. We're part of those North Woods when we grew up. I mean, I spent the entire day on Lake Superior as a kid, we Lake Superior is the coldest. Oh my God, it's so cold. But we would be in there all day. And I can remember my cousin Henry, who was a couple of years younger than me. He had to be maybe all of 6 years old. But I remember he was so skinny, and he'd stand there, his whole body shaking, and he was literally completely blue. I don't know why our parents, I mean, we probably could have gotten hypothermia and drowned out there, but they, you know, they just let us go all day. You know, we'd be diving for a white rock, and that's how we spent our days, in that ice cold water of Lake Superior. So, you know, the North Woods brings a lot of possibilities, certainly where we are. It's snow country. Spoke to my brother Jimmy the other day, and they got 40 inches of snow. So that's kind of ordinary there. And, you know, when I was a weathercaster in Duluth, Minnesota, we had two solid weeks of 25 below with 90 below wind chill effect off the lake. So what time of year was it that you did this heroic journey?
Well, it was a 3-month trip in which we were moving north. So we had everything from, it was 105 degrees and we were getting blisters from the sun, to it was so cold when we woke up that everything was covered in frost. And Anne always joked with me that I had Miami blood, because I would just be like shivering by our tent and she would be running around getting everything ready to go. And I'm like, how are you moving right now? So we really experienced a spectrum of weather and of challenges. But I think, you know, related to your story, you're so immersed in it. At that point, it's such a part of your life. Something like the direction of the wind was perhaps the most important thing that we would have to figure out every morning. And we could do that by just looking out at the water and seeing which way the ripples were just starting to go. And we could tell what the rest of our day was going to be like. And that's something that, you know, living in Minneapolis, you know, I care if it's windy or it's not windy, but you know, the exact direction of the wind and the exact wind speed doesn't impact my life in the same intimate way that it changed everything for us back in those times.
But that's a wonderful point, because you became attuned to nature in a way that you would not have had the opportunity to experience if you were not challenging the ability to connect in such a powerful way with the planet itself. My grandmother, after my grandfather passed away, remarried someone who was a fisherman there on Lake Superior. And he always brought all of these interesting, he knew things about the weather, and he warned everybody about that Oronto Creek so many times. And, you know, and the engineers didn't pay attention to him, but he knew what he was talking about, because he was in it and with it. And if only we could encourage people to be, and myself included, I have businesses, and I have that as an excuse not to be out on the land and be participating in the nature of this planet itself. And, you know, what can we say to the young people, what they're missing, you know? I don't know.
I mean, you can't make someone else get you out the door.
Well, I have kind of godchildren, and I remember when they were young, and I asked them to come and visit me here. And we went up to a part of Oak Creek Canyon that's called Slide Rock. Mm-hmm. And people get in the river and you slide down the rock in the river, because that's the way the rock formation is. And it was very foreign to them. And I knew that they had all been consumed with, you know, the video games, and, you know, it's a great babysitter for moms and dads who, you know, would rather have them occupied. And unfortunately now, I mean, you know, we, when we, in Wisconsin, we used to leave in the morning and Then we'd hear our mom call, "Kathy, time for dinner," you know, this. And that's when we'd come home. Mm-hmm. But we were out all day in the, you know, in the outdoors. And this is almost something that is, it's not even talked about. There's no conversation, because now, you know, you have to be careful. You have to keep an eye on your kid, because it's a world that's dangerous in ways that are so unseemly, you know?
Yeah, it's a really tricky space. And I think a lot is, look, there's a lot of new knowledge. And I think there's a lot too that has been disregarded or forgotten in terms of, you know, being out in the world as a form of knowledge production, right? Like we're thinking a lot about technology and STEM and like all, you know, science, and all this is so, so important. But I think sometimes it feels a little bit disconnected if you don't also have a relationship with, you know, the places that you're studying or learning about. And, you know, I think the biggest example that I have from my expeditions is about water quality. You know, you can read about degrading.
Oh, yes.
You can read about, you know, water shortages, but we were moving with a fairly connected system of water over 2,000 miles and learning and experiencing, you know, going from a polluted agricultural river and filling up our water and the struggles with that and like hitchhiking into towns. And even on Lake Winnipeg, where the algal blooms are so bad from the agricultural runoff that we couldn't even safely filter water to drink in Canada. Then we end up on this scenic Arctic river where we're just drinking directly from the water source. And it going through that experience, I think, does something to you in terms of connecting the dots of these larger social and environmental issues and understanding interconnectivity and how our actions on land, for example, greatly impact the water and its ability to do what it does best, which is, you know, like provide life, and really suffocated it in that way. And I don't think that I would feel that so deeply in my body if I hadn't experienced it firsthand.
Absolutely. Well, Lake Superior years ago was being polluted. And thankfully, Gino Pellucci, who was a family friend, we're all Italians, a lot of us are Italians up there, but he really did something to stop that pollution. I think that was from the taconite mining or something. I can't remember quite what it was. But I mean, when we were living on Lake Superior, you know, we had our deep sea fishing resort there, our family, but, you know, our cabins and, you know, the lodge, everything was, we took our water from Lake Superior. The water in Lake Superior was so pure and clear and pristine. And then all of a sudden, you know, we were in danger of having, you know, terrible health effects from it. So it's, only, you know, I think that if you're really not having an opportunity to be connected in that way, we do lose sight of it. Even if you're someone who really believes in doing something about the environment, and I mean, Gary Null is such an activist on behalf of the planet and the situations of lack of water and so on and so forth. He's been such a champion for so many years, way before anybody was really saying something about it, you know. And I think you might be a wonderful guest for his show, because you had such a direct experience of the water and the changes that, you know, you experienced. So where are you at? Do you try to do something about these things that are polluting the waterways?
So when I was going on these expeditions in my early and mid-20s, it sometimes was sort of like a screw the man type of thing. You know, I'm going to live in a canoe for 3 months. When really it set my entire career into motion, because the things that I learned on those trips directed me toward environmental work, because I couldn't unsee all of the things that I had seen and was so shocked by in my body in those spaces. And And so everything I've done since then has been specifically water and river related. I worked in environmental education and then environmental, you know, land protection and policy. And now I am working as a part of a research team at the University of Minnesota on how we value water quality on the Mississippi River. And so I'm collecting sort of human narratives to better tell how people are connected to water in a way that when we make policies, we're looking at like these cost-benefit reports. We're looking at how we can monetize different things. And so much of relationships with water really can't be monetized in terms of these cultural values, in terms of, you know, connections to certain species, things that are really missed in these larger bird's eye views. And so a lot of my work is trying to unearth and elevate those stories now.
Wow. That's wonderful to hear that you're doing these things. And now I noticed, I mean, you offer a lot of various services even on your website, right? Because you wrote your book. Is this the first of several, perhaps?
I would assume so.
Mm-hmm. And so what are some of the things that you offer to others from your direct experience?
Yes, I do environmental communications consulting. I'm just finishing up my PhD in communication studies in environmental communication. And so I've had the great privilege of researching and reading and critiquing the ways in which how we talk about the environment or how we talk about nature, something separate, has a really big impact on how we perceive and take actions about environmental issues. And so I do a lot of different things, but a lot of that is writing and editing and trying to like hone in on how to better communicate environmental problems.
Mm-hmm. And so you offer those skills to other people that might need some polishing of those skills themselves, right? Good. Very good. So I know we can't show photographs, but I really urge people to go. So those videos, there are links on your website for those videos that I viewed. And that sort of, opportunity for them. Good. Do you happen to have your journal handy?
Ooh.
You do.
Yeah, and I have
I think I would love to hear some of those sections that I heard looking at the video. By your reading the journal, it just brings people into the direct experience of it. And I would really love it if you would take the opportunity to read some passages that you find, something that would bring value to people as they listen. And bring us to wherever you're going to read. What part of the journey were you on when you wrote these particular passages in your journal?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that there are so many passages it might be hard to pick one.
Well, I could read the prologue of my book, which is just 3 pages.
Mm-hmm.
Provide some greater context of sort of the expedition and what we took away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could also read, I think you're probably talking about the section of my journal, which is the last journal entry I wrote on our.
Yes, it was. That was the one that was on that video. And I thought, oh my goodness. I mean, I was just right there with you, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I could do both. I could do one or the other. Do you have a preference?
Well, we've got about 25 minutes left. So what would you say? I mean, I really loved that part, last part.
I can just do the journal entry.
Okay.
Right, and 1 second.
Yes, I understand your condition very well.
Oh, great.
Because I have one of my own.
So this is, I know you can't see this, but this journal is
wow,
in my hands, and I have taped it back together. But on the expedition to Hudson Bay, we journaled almost every single day, with the exception we were so tired on the Red River that there's 3 or 4 days where I didn't journal at all. And when I went back to write my book, I just have no idea what happened on those days. journal entry in a small cabin on the shores of Hudson Bay in York Factory, Manitoba. So it accounts our last day. We ran several rapids until we reached White Mud Falls, our last set, portage, anything. I felt very emotional because I knew that after this portage, there was nothing that could stop us from making it to York Factory. The last few days brought emotional and physical challenges that left us exhausted and sore. After almost 3 months on trail, we were finally ready to end our trip. I felt a lack of nutrition had worn on my health, and I couldn't wait until I could eat fruits and vegetables again. While the hope of York Factory and relaxation was at our fingertips, we still had 200 kilometers to go on the river and the rumors of polar bear country echoing in our minds. We paddled hard. Endurance and longevity are our strengths, and we planned to make the 4-day trip from White Mud to York Factory in a mere 2 days. Our day lasted 15 hours before the sun made us retire to the shore. The moon did not show as we built our first fire to fight the cold. We planned to stay up all night, but after an hour, we felt the weight of our exhaustion and gave in to the comfort of our tent and sleeping bags. Ironically, for Anne, it was one of her best nights of sleep, despite our anxiety in polar bear country. I slept, but I dreamt of creatures surrounding the tent and felt a deep sorrow that we would never actually make it to the end. We left camp that morning without breakfast and continued on the flowing haze. We heard stories of thick fog and dark clouds typical to this section of the river, but we had a clear morning. We approached the turn where the God's River joins the haze and saw our first woodland caribou swimming across the water. The current quickened at the conjunction, and we had a floating breakfast of cold quinoa and chili powder from the night before. We continued on our way. With 10 more hours of paddling ahead, we felt as far away from York Factory as we ever had. Our wrists ached, hands clenched, and minds more than anything were on the verge of insanity. The river was beautiful, though. There were high white mud cliffs on the right and low-lying spruces on the left, decorating the shoreline, always reminding us of our desolation. Our strokes slowed and stomachs turned, and we became desperate for the hours to pass. All of a sudden, from behind us, we heard a huge clap of thunder that spooked us both. Just then, a pack of wolves, 5 total, 1 black, came out to the riverbank from behind the spruce. The air was still. There was a suspicious calm. The wolves stopped in their tracks when they felt our presence. We stared. They stared. Maihan barked. A bird made a loud cry, and the sound brought goosebumps to our skin. We glanced at the dark cloud floating behind us, and we were off with the motivation reminiscent of our efforts on the Red River. We reached the rock, a big rock on the riverbank that signified our remaining distance of 50 kilometers, 40 kilometers, 30 kilometers, 2 more hours. We sang every song we knew, including some Christmas medleys. We saw seals, caribou, black bear. Every white rock looked as if it were swimming our way, and I joked that someone should spray paint them all black to soothe the nerves of canoeists on the haze. We were 10 kilometers away. We were hungry, tired, and desperate. It felt as though something could still go wrong. A storm? A bear? Could we really just arrive unscathed at York Factory? We passed the point where the tide effect would slow us down, but we were still moving steadily toward the bay. We turned left, and there it was, Hudson Bay. Overwhelmed with hunger, we did not joyously celebrate the sight of the bay, but solemnly paddled toward it. I didn't know what to say to Anne, and I didn't quite know how to feel. These last few days have been some of the most trying days of my life, and I knew I could relax now, but I felt an emptiness as well. This has been my lifestyle for 85 days, and there was no party or trophy at the end, just a set of stairs leading up to a building that once manufactured York boats. How was this a major destination for canoeists? Who made the bay into a rite of passage? The history is interesting, and we were in awe at the expanse of water. But what made our voyage so significant and important to others? I do not yet understand the magnitude of our adventure and the importance of being the first two women to complete it. I'm sure I will reflect on these questions for years to come. That was
bravo.
Words.
That's so wonderful. So let me ask you this. How did you carry your supplies? What did you eat?
We carried a month of food with us at a time. And Anne and I were trained in wilderness canoe tripping. And so we didn't have the sort of prepackaged meals that you add hot water to or anything like that. We knew, you know, how many pounds of what to pack out per day, per person. And so we had a lot of like pastas and rice, and sometimes we would have dehydrated vegetables mixed in there. And for lunch, we would have, you know, salami and cheese and tortillas. But I mentioned in my journal entry that I was really hungry. And I remember, you know, I had these white lines on my fingertips. I was very calcium deficient, because when we were in Norway House, Cree First Nation, right before we departed, unbeknownst to us, a stray dog ate all of our lunch bag. And so we and, you know, lunch comes around and I'm like, Anne, get the lunch bag. And she's like, you get the lunch bag. And I'm like, no, I'm pretty sure it's up there. And we realized, you know, we didn't have any of our fresh food for the last 3 weeks of our expedition. And it wasn't worth it to turn back at that point. So we made every variation of Bisquick you could possibly imagine. And it really started to wear on our health after a while. And that was sort of a big part, too, of ending the trip and just being able, looking forward to eating food again. I remember so there are three caretakers who live at York Factory. It used to be a community of over 300 people. This is where the Hudson Bay Company was stationed, and they were building their huge boats for fur trading routes. But now it's just this historic site that you can only get to by float plane or by boat, so they don't get a lot of visitors. And we got there, and they said, well, it's a good thing you're here, because the season is ending early, and we're all leaving tomorrow.
Oh, my.
And we're like, we just paddled 200 kilometers in 2 days. And so they were able to open their refrigerators and let us eat the rest of their stash of food. And I throwing spinach into my mouth, just chewing on raw spinach and thinking it was a beautiful thing that had ever happened.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, that, you know, because I've done certain processes, spiritual processes where, you know, 3 days in a room by myself with blindfolds and an apple, you know, just to bring you into certain states of mind internally. Mm-hmm. But this, I'm sure, created some unexpected internal experiences that you likely were not even considering.
Yeah, and I think a big part of that, too, is we had a fishing pole. And so the reality was like, well, if we're going to eat a good dinner, we have to catch it and we have to prepare it. And, you know, food isn't just readily available, and to actually go through that process was really quite life-changing.
So you did fish?
We did fish.
And I assume you had to stop to do the fishing. You couldn't paddle and fish.
Yeah, we weren't leisurely fishers. We would get to camp, and then we would see if we could catch anything at night. But we were mostly paddling throughout the day.
Wow. So how many hours a day were you actually paddling?
Sunrise to sunset. So that depended on what time of year.
The time of year.
That was 15 hours in August. It was more
wow.
Like 12 hours.
Well, do you still have power arms?
My right arm is huge. Not my left arm. I preferred a certain side in the canoe, and so did Anne. And so both of us sort of have this funky thing where one side of our body is much stronger than the other.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that would be a study in itself, huh?
Yeah, just walking around in circles over here.
Wow. Well, do you think, is there time for you to read that introductory page?
Absolutely.
We have 10 minutes.
Yes, I can do that.
And then I hope that this inspires people to buy your book and read all of it.
Thank you. Sometimes a great adventure lands in your lap. That's exactly what happened on a chilly February day in my dorm room at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. Anne flung open the door of my room with fire in her eyes and a book in her hand. I had been cooped up all day writing a paper. The interruption, although abrupt, was a welcome break to a gloomy and uneventful day. She lingered in the doorway with a familiar smirk on her face. "Yes, Anne? How can I help you this fine evening?" I said facetiously. We'd been scheming trips together for 4 years, and it seemed every adventure started with Anne standing in the doorway with that same expression. She threw the book at me from across the room. "Read this," she said. "We should do it." I looked down at the book, Canoeing with the Cree, now lying on the bed in front of me. There was a silhouette of two people paddling a canoe on the cover. I looked back up to respond, but Anne was gone. The monotony of the day was getting to me. I needed a break. Reading a chapter or two would provide a welcome respite from schoolwork. But after the first few chapters, I just kept going, flying through the story of two men, Eric Severide and Walter C. Port, who in 1930 paddled from Minneapolis to Hudson Bay. They were fresh out of high school and didn't have sleeping bags or maps for the long journey. Their story was documented by the Minneapolis Star, and their adventurous spirit brought them to the shores of Hudson Bay, inspiring supporters and skeptics across the country. Severide and Port traveled through agricultural rivers and wild waters of the North. I began wondering what those rivers looked like today. If we decided to make the trip, would we too get lost on Mud Lake near the headwaters of the Minnesota River and be hopelessly windbound on Lake Winnipeg? Hours passed as I continued reading, furiously flipping pages about the Native community at Norway House and how Eric and Walter went to church at York Factory on the shores of Hudson Bay. Meanwhile, the gray sky outside my window had turned to black. The cafeteria was long closed by now, so I shoved a granola bar into my mouth and finished the last few pages of the book by headlamp. I closed the book and shut my eyes. Yes, I want to do this trip, I thought. Why not? Everyone around me was frantically applying for jobs, and very few people were hearing back from prospective employers. What else was I going to do after graduation? I wanted something more than the seemingly predictable life path in front of me. I felt an itch to do something crazy. An energy inside me was overflowing, yearning to get out and get going, and no internship or entry-level job could fulfill my desire to live and breathe and feel the earth around me. The next day, I threw the book back at Anne and said, "I'm in." What I didn't know was just what I was signing up for, or how it would profoundly change my perceptions of everything around me. My city upbringing and higher education did not prepare me to unbiasedly interact with people who were different from myself. Yet on this expedition, I would be forced into uncomfortable situations with people from a variety of backgrounds, especially political, and would slowly begin to witness the complex web of humanity. Preparing for our expedition to Hudson Bay taught us several life skills. In many ways, it was like starting our own business. I learned more about communication, public relations, fundraising, event planning, and marketing than I ever had at school. I initially saw this trip as a hole in my resume. In reality, it was the key component to unfolding my career. There is a big difference between going on an expedition and just going camping. On an expedition, you feel a sense of urgency to continue on a trail and will relax only long enough to rejuvenate. When camping, you're there to relax and enjoy the surroundings. You don't feel the need to push yourself beyond your comfort zone just to cover more ground. I'm not sure what made us so focused and driven to reach Hudson Bay. I often thought about the psychology behind what makes anyone hell-bent on one thing, while knowing that, in the big scheme of things, their greatest passions seem minuscule and unimportant. Before and during the trip, Anne and I knew that nothing would stop us from making it to the bay. Sometimes we would turn it into a game. "What if a bear bites my leg off?" Anne would ask. We'd temporarily evacuate, go to a hospital for bandages, and then I would portage you for the rest of the trip. "What if our boat capsizes and sinks to the bottom of Lake Winnipeg?" I'd ask. We'd swim to shore, find help, and use all our money to get another boat. This game of what if gave us the confidence and determination to continue on through the most challenging parts of our journey. For 85 days, we faced fierce weather, wild animals, and changing communities. The biggest unforeseen challenge, however, was to our own relationship. How could two best friends reach a point where they had to resort to communicating through handwritten letters, even though day in and day out, they were always within feet of each other? This is the story of how Anne Rejo and I became the first two women to recreate Eric Severide and Walter Port's route to Hudson Bay, a route that has been attempted and sometimes completed many times since it was popularized in 1930. It is also an account of the present-day condition of the lakes and rivers between the Twin Cities and Hudson Bay, the people who live on these waters, and the communities that shape them. It explores the intrinsic connection that human beings have to moving water and reflects on the raw challenges we faced as two women making history.
Beautifully written. Yeah. Beautifully written. Really good jobs. It's very impressive. So, I think, that I hope that this segment of Wise Women does, in fact, inspire others. I don't know if they might be, willing to take the kinds of adventurous risks that you and Anne did. But and where is Anne now? What is she doing?
Anne is in Colorado. She lives at the bottom of the ski hill in Steamboat Springs, and she is a data scientist. She does climate change modeling work for a startup company based in DC. So,
wow,
does really smart, fancy things that I can't quite describe.
Yeah, I'm sure that there are many unusual careers today that were not around years ago, and making contributions where they're needed. Mm-hmm. So this is a good thing. And so you're expecting another child.
I am. Yes. It's been a really fun stage of life to, and I know I'm just in my mid-30s and that there's a, you know, whole life ahead of me, but it really does feel like I jammed as much adventure as possible into my earlier years, and now I'm in this phase of giving back. And you know, we use a canoe in our backyard as a playpen, and just
how cute is that?
It's actually very effective. I highly recommend it. It's an expensive playpen, though. But yeah, just like being able to pass it on in more of a family setting, and who knows what my children will do.
Well, you could be the inventor of something. If not, you could create a playpen in the shape of a canoe that might not have the necessary requirements of the canoe itself. It could be less expensive. One of my favorite shows is Shark Tank. I watch it often. I learn a great deal by watching these entrepreneurs with their ideas that they expand. So, you know, you might have something there, young lady.
Yeah, it's a funny balance of, you know, how much brainwashing is too much brainwashing. Like, will they love it or will they turn the other way?
Mm-hmm. Now, you said you have a 2-year-old, male or female?
I have a 2.5-year-old girl named Lucy.
Oh, my. Okay. And do you know the next event? Have you just found out if it's a boy or a girl?
We find out this Thursday. Yeah, we shall see. But Lucy's first word was boat. So that's
no way. Wow. You're kidding. That is adorable. Wow. So she might follow in your footsteps.
We shall see. And you know, going to a wilderness camp for me at such a developmental period in life was really important. And so I think, you know, at the very least, you know, as you're saying, like, with these things aren't as incorporated in our day-to-day lives as, you know, they were when you were growing up. It's not like go play in the woods and then your mom will tell you when dinner is, but I think there still are some vital, some important gateways into building those relationships with nature, which, you know, have huge impacts on how you just sort of make decisions and try to advocate for important issues after you experience being in, and I hate to say in nature, because like so much is nature and we've been programmed to think that it's something different than what is already available to us in our backyards. But I'm really excited to send my children to camps to see if they cling to those types of things or not.
Yes. Well, when I was growing up in the North Woods, there were so many camps in the North Woods where I was. And in fact, when I was 16, one of the camp counselors was the first boy I ever kissed. He was so cute. I wonder where he is now. Yeah, because my dad we had a restaurant, and one night, about 8 of them walked in, one cuter than the other. My heart was just, you know, pumping. And my dad had his eye on me, boy. Oh, mamma mia.
Were you needing a wish?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. There were so many. I can't remember the names of those camps. But and they were the sons of the Notre Dame coaches. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were quite something. They bring back some precious memories. Well, Natalie Warren, you have been a wonderful guest, an inspiring force for those who are listening. And I'm so grateful that you have such an adventurous spirit to share with others. And I expect to see wonderful things continuing in your life to, you know, bring forth important issues. I know you're an activist for the planet itself, and I know that your book and more to come will be inspiration to those who can take the torch and lead the way that you've done.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's been really lovely to talk with you and to share stories and to hear some of your own as well.
Thank you so much. All right, Natalie, you take care, and I hope we speak again.
Okay.
Okay, well, thank all of you for listening to Wise Women. This is Kathleen Francis, your host, wishing you a wonderful rest of your week. And please do tune in again. We have some wonderful guests that are coming forward to bring the wisdom that we need to share, want to share, and hope you will continue listening. Take good care. Bye-bye.
God of creation.